Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in. Today, we're going to talk about two stories that were ripped from the headlines, as they say, that are stranger than fiction. Those stories are the heist at the Louvre and the gambling fiasco that ensnared high-profile people in the NBA. Let's kick things off with the Louvre, a true crime that has launched a million memes. Picture Pink Panther-style reenactments of how someone could break into one of the world's most precious and crowded museums and walk out with crown jewels in broad daylight. Oh, and then descend a long, slow ladder that was right out there in public to get away. Here's KCBS with the latest on the Louvre and how in the world this could have happened.
Paris prosecutors today are saying that the crown jewels stolen from the Louvre are estimated to be worth more than $100 million, and they've got 100 investigators on the case. For more, we're joined live, Aaron Thompson, professor of art crime at City University of New York. We'll talk about being right in your wheelhouse, right?
Exactly.
So when I first heard about this on Sunday, I was thinking about an episode of Lupin, the French burglar that is on Netflix. I mean, is this art as imitating, you know, life, or is this, I mean, what surprises you about this?
Well, the thing about movies and TV about art crime is they make it look a lot harder than it is. Museums have usually pretty terrible security. And the Louvre is a historic building. You can't knock it down and build the secure facility. So it has big, beautiful windows looking out over the street, which were used to rob it in this occasion.
When you found out, because everybody's kind of like, you know, analyzing what they did, they used sort of like this cherry picker thing and drove it right up to the edge of the museum and then just cut through the glass with, you know, a disc cutter. It seems pretty, not very sophisticated.
Well, what's surprising to me is there are actually a lot of daytime thefts for museums, but most people just buy a ticket and walk in like everybody else. The museum's open. So I'm kind of surprised they went to so much trouble, although it did give them a pretty good escape route.
Yeah, because they got away on, what, scooters with you know, yep, jewelry hanging out of their pockets?
Well, they dropped a crown, which is not really a super pro behavior. And more worrisome for them, they left behind one of their motorcycle helmets. So I'm sure police are working overtime to find the DNA evidence on that.
Yeah, I heard that there was DNA evidence on the crown that, or the jewelry that was left behind. And I wonder, is there some database, some Interpol database of international art thieves?
Well, there's very few people who make a living stealing from museums. It's usually a pretty stupid thing to do, because if you steal the Mona Lisa, say, the first time you try and go and sell it, somebody's going to say, let me just go call the police. So the people who hit museums are usually professional burglars, but they steal from homes, from apartments, from shops. So that's the type of suspect that the police are likely looking at, is professional jewelry thieves.
Yeah, I was thinking, I read that they are probably going to try and, you know, disassemble the jewelry and sell the stones and maybe melt down the gold or something like that, which, you know, it takes into account the actual value of it, but there's the historical value as well.
Yeah, but it's just easier to get away with something if you're selling a blob of gold rather than an identifiable piece of jewelry. A few years ago, a Pennsylvania man was caught. He robbed sports memorabilia museums across America for 2 decades and then just melted down all of the trophies. He stole all of Yogi Berra's World Series rings, and they were worth over $1 million on the memorabilia market, but he only got about $10,000 for the gold in them.
Why aren't museums better secure?
Well, think about it. Where else can you go and get your nose within a couple inches of things that are worth millions of dollars? You can't go be a tourist in Fort Knox. Museums are sort of weird places where we're supposed to be in a calm, contemplative environment next to priceless objects without an armed guard breathing down our necks. So there's only so much they can do. And a lot of museums really depend upon the fact that you're going to get caught if you steal things from display, recognizable paintings or sculptures. So they sacrifice a little in security to make it a more welcoming space for art lovers.
I wonder why the Louvre, because it feels like a really high-profile smash and grab, because you don't see them doing this at the Tower of London.
Well, actually, a few years ago, a toilet a functioning toilet made out of 18-karat gold by the artist Maurizio Cattelan was taken out of Blenheim Palace in the UK and immediately melted down. So really, any place where you've got a tempting amount of goodies on display is a security risk.
Based on your experience, what do you think is going to happen next? Are they going to find these people, or are they ever going to retrieve the goods?
In cases like this, the people who actually are the guys who go in, who do the dirty work, are hired hands. They are almost always caught using security footage, traffic cams, rental car receipts, DNA evidence. So they are probably not very wise to take the sort of job. The masterminds who hire them are much more rarely caught, and then almost never do you recover the stolen goods if they are able to be disassembled, melted down. Really, our only hope is that they'll get into a fight about the larger gems, which have to be recut, and maybe turn each other in. That happened when gems were stolen from the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
Another storyline Hollywood loves is seedy gambling rings. And here we turn to this story. Portland Trail Blazers head coach Chauncey Billups and Miami Heat guard Terry Rozier are among more than 30 people charged in connection with schemes involving illegal sports, betting, and rigged poker games backed by mafia. The indictments are related to two major cases, one involving sports betting and the second involving rigged poker games. Here's more on that from KCBS.
Today, federal officials are sharing details of a global investigation that busted a multi-million dollar gambling operation with ties to NBA figures and organized crime. Among those arrested, Trailblazers coach, 2024 NBA Hall of Fame inductee Chauncey Billups, and 10-year veteran point guard Terry Rozier. This comes months after the NBA concluded its own gambling investigation. To help us break down what this means for the sports world, we're joined live by independent sports journalist June Lee, whose work has appeared in the New York Times, ESPN, and the Washington Post. Our Stephen Langford is also here. The investigation was called Operation Royal Flush. What can you tell us about how it went down?
Yeah, so over the course of the last few years, there's been investigations into Terry Rozier in particular. That was made public a few years ago into whether or not he was using these prop bets, which are bets on small actions that can happen within a sports game. And there were some bets that were made that kind of caught the eye of federal investigators and regulators that seemed unusual. There was a game when Terry Rozier was playing for the Charlotte Hornets where he exited with a foot injury, and there were a particular number of bets that profited greatly off of Rozier leaving that game. As a result, federal investigators began looking into Rozier, and they discovered a gambling ring that involved former Cleveland Cavaliers assistant coach Damon Jones that was also in connection to illegal poker games that are happening in conjunction with the New York City Italian Mafia that also implicated Portland Trailblazers head coach Chauncey Billups, who was coaching a game as recently as last night.
Yeah, unbelievable stuff. And June, great to talk with. As far as Rozier's arrest, the previous NBA investigation found he didn't violate any of their rules. What exactly happened there? Did the NBA not do enough digging? Did the NBA maybe even sweep this one under the rug as sports betting was rapidly rising? I'm very confused with the Rozier situation.
I don't have any original reporting on what happened with the NBA investigation, so I don't want to speculate that on that in particular. What I will say is that the optics for the NBA doing their own investigation, that reporting then getting leaked out to ESPN over the course of the last year or so, and then after the NBA, quote-unquote, clearing Terry Rozier, the FBI coming in and arresting Terry Rozier, is a very, very bad look for the NBA, because so much of the language that has existed around sports gambling since its legalization and the mass adoption of the sports gambling apps across the country has been, you know, this is something that allows us to better regulate and better get a sense of when illegal things may or may not be happening. If the NBA looked at the situation and found nothing, and it turns out the federal investigators are coming in and finding something different, it speaks poorly to the NBA's ability to regulate itself and find bad actors within the system.
Gambling on sports is everywhere now. It's legal in many locations, not in California, but you have DraftKings and the like. Is that just exacerbating a problem that's been around as long as there's been sports?
I think that there's a larger cultural shift that's happening in the United States right now. I'm actually working on an op-ed for the New York Times on this topic and have been leading up to this moment, so the timing is kind of serendipitous there. But it's a situation where I think that throughout all of our culture currently, I think that there's this gambling mindset that has taken over. I mean, I think one of the things that really kind of blew this out of, blew my mind in regards to how much gambling culture has taken over was when the assassination of Charlie Kirk took place. And I remember seeing tweets about Tauchi and Polymarket, these speculation markets that are essentially gambling apps about pretty much anything that can happen in the world, taking down their markets on Charlie Kirk's political future, whether or not he might run for president one day. And so we're living in this world where it's not just the ability to gamble on sports, you can gamble on the future of politicians. There was speculation about whether or not Vladimir Zelensky would wear a suit again to the White House. I was walking down the street here in New York City, and you can see these ads for Kalshi and Polymarket that are putting the odds up for whether or not Zora Mamdani is going to beat Andrew Cuomo in the mayor's race. This is not just a situation that is limited to just sports now. This gambling mindset, I think, has pervaded almost all of our culture, and I think is emblematic of just how much our engagement with our society now is tied to whether or not we can make a financial return from the results of how things happen in our world.
And especially with prop bets in sports, it got to the point where the NBA commissioner Adam Silver went on ESPN and called on his partners to decrease the amount of prop bets that you can place. But will this type of thing, if this continues to snowball, will it impact the partnerships with the likes of FanDuel or DraftKings, which have been partners of the NBA since 2021?
I mean, we'll see, because a huge part of the reason why the NBA was able to get more money for its broadcasting rights, whether it's with NBC or with Amazon, and this is true across all the sports leagues, even though ratings aren't necessarily up enormously, sports gambling has been a huge savior to the industry due to television ratings falling because of cable cutting. And sports betting has kind of been the solution that the leagues themselves have presented to themselves as, here's how we make back the money that we're not making from cable and people who don't watch sports subsidizing the broadcast of NBA games, MLB games, NFL games. And so they're in this really tight position now where a lot of these broadcast partners have major sports gambling advertisements. Most sports media podcasts, most sports podcasts have gambling advertising on it. A lot of the industry is completely, in large ways, is funded by sports media, sports media funneling people towards gambling. And so there is a larger systemic issue here where I feel a lot of the media is compromised in being able to talk about this issue because they take so much money from sports gambling. And that's just kind of a reflection of the state of the media industry as a whole, where people don't want to lose their jobs. Understandably so. I was part of the ESPN layoffs in 2023. And as a result, there's just less conversation about how much gambling is changing our relationship to sports.
This latest investigation involves NBA veterans, a Hall of Fame player and coach, Chauncey Billups, among those tied up in this. But are you concerned about younger athletes, too? Is gambling permeating the college ranks, even high school, which has turned into big business?
Yeah, I'm concerned just about how much this gambling mindset is changing the way that people play sports. I talk to athletes who say that regardless of how well they perform, good or bad, they're getting harassed in their DMs on social media because someone is always losing. If they pitch well, someone is losing. If they pitch poorly, someone is losing. And I think that it's changing your relationship to fandom. The way that people used to root for their favorite teams or their favorite players, people are now primarily rooting for their bets. And I think that in itself, I think, is shifting our relationship to sports as well. And I think one of the things that really concerns me is how much this has become normalized among young people in America. This is their way to engage with sports, and they don't necessarily know anything different. And I think that when sports is framed in such a transactional lens, I think it takes out a lot of the soul of what has made it special. Like, ultimately, why I love following sports is following the long arcs of my favorite team, the satisfaction of following a team rebuild itself and potentially win a championship. When someone engages with sports primarily through the lens of sports betting, those stories don't necessarily hold the same value. And I think that it changes the way that you engage with in the world and with your own life.
Chad Hartman at WCCO Radio in Minneapolis has interesting thoughts about how the gambling scandal highlights a problem with young men today. Disconnection, disaffection, and more. Here's Chad.
Then we have the tens of millions of younger individuals who, for a combination of reasons, number one is this thing, the phone again. COVID played a part, but let's not act like this wasn't going on well before COVID, where the thought of going out and interacting with society, with civilization, they're repulsed by that. They're afraid of that. They feel like it's unnecessary. You got another story today about Gen Z and sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
Want to explain that one?
Well, we've had stories for months now about how Gen Z is just not having the relationships and the amount of sex, literally, that previous generations did. And the story today is not only that, they're not interested in watching movie and TV shows that have sex, relationship drama, things like that.
Yeah. It's the phone debate and the social media debate. How long could all of us function without our phone? And then I will still defend many, many aspects of social media, which make our life better. But to deny the power it has on those who you never thought they could get to, or the ones you worried about, it's everywhere. And this ties back to not as much the poker part with Chauncey, but the betting. And yes, it's Damon Jones. Yes, it's Terry Rozier. But unless there is a radical step back, and I think the chances are zero, don't you? I don't think this is going to be Adam Silver, Gary Bettman, Rob Manfred, and Roger Goodell say, we're giving up billions, basically, and we're out of the business.
Yeah. Move the Raiders back to Oakland.
Yeah, we're done with
Take
Vegas.
Take the Golden Knights, send them somewhere. No, there's way too much money.
And, again, a couple texts, you know, why are you surprised? I didn't say I was surprised, but you can anticipate something happening or the possibility and then still be like, whoa, it finally happened.
Yeah, it's not like this hasn't happened before.
And
many, many, many decades ago,
yes,
athletes were being...
Oh, God, yeah. And so how many others were pursued? I mean, you think Terry Rozier and Damon Jones, that's it? Come on. Class A with the Guardians, come on. How many others are still doing it right now and the authorities just don't know about it? And will this even cause them to step back? And as a texter said, we got in this debate a little bit ago where there is a bill being debated now to allow college athletes to bet on pro sports. You're kidding me, right? We really need more of that? Is that right? My 35-year-old son and his friends talk about online gambling as if it's an investment, like putting money into a retirement account.
Oh, my.
I bet there are, again, not exaggerating, tens of millions of parents who could say the same thing.
Let's talk to our friend Kelly Stimson, who is with us once again, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, also a former local, state, federal, and military prosecutor. I'm going to ask you to kind of give us the lay of the land of what the FBI revealed today regarding this gambling ring, money laundering ring that has busted up. It has to do with crime families. It has to do with the NBA, illegal fraudulent poker games. When you read about this story, what can you tell us?
Well, it's an amazing indictment. I just read it within the hour, and it takes a long time to sort of digest what these NBA
and Gambino crime family folks were doing. But in essence, this was the deal. They had poker games that were supposed to be just straight up poker games. And they would bring in these fancy pro basketball players to be playing against other mopes who didn't know that the games were rigged. But they had technology that allow the cheating teams, who were some of the NBA players and others, to have the inside scoop on the cards. They would then dupe these unwitting players, get lots of money, and then pass the money on to the Gambino crime family. And then they would also place bets on games, and some of these players would coerce some of the other players who were not in on it, who gambled, to take a knee, to drop out of a game, to shove the game. So, look, cheating in pro sports is not new. I mean, you know, you all remember Charlie Hustle, Pete Rose, and the Boston College stuff, and it goes way back. But this is really sophisticated stuff. And so I think just if you read the indictment alone, it's really confusing for a lawyer who hasn't done prosecutions, because this was really sophisticated. And my guess is, reading the news articles on it and listening to Cash Patel's press conference, they have thousands of hours of video, of wiretaps, of emails. And so I think people are going to start rolling really soon and trying to get the best deal they can.
Mm-hmm. That's going to become interesting. Here's my main question for you, Cully. Here in St. Louis, we don't have an NBA team. So there's not a close relationship to the NBA like there is professional baseball, soccer, hockey. We have a complicated relationship with the NFL here in St. Louis, of course. Do you find that this story is going to permeate the interests of the American people outside of those that are connected to the names, the actual literal players that have been involved in this? Is this story bigger than the league?
It's too early to tell, in my opinion, because I think this indictment is just the beginning, frankly, because when you see that the Bonanno and the Gambino and the Genovese crime families are involved, and then you add the extra bling of NBA players and coaches, just because right now we don't know, or at least don't think, that there's any connection to professional athletes in St. Louis or other people, I bet you that the spider web of this indictment and this ripple effect of this indictment is going to touch a lot of players and people besides the named people in the indictment. So I think it's way too early to tell. And of course, you know, betting on pro sports is nothing new. And getting caught illegally betting on pro sports when you're a pro athlete or a coach is not new. But this takes it to a whole new level when you're not doing it to gain money for yourself. You're doing it to, you're funneling it through known mafia families who then essentially kneecap or coerce other players to rig games so people who are betting on games can have the upper hand. So this is much more sophisticated than the average mope who's trying to make money for himself.
And then one last follow-up question regarding the NBA story before we shift into something completely different. In your understanding, they're the people who are sitting down and playing those poker games. Those have to be high rollers, the very high stakes games in order for it to be worthy of that time. When we're talking about players who are involved in something, the separate charge of what was going on specifically with the NBA players, Rozier, who apparently took himself out of a game and faked an injury and stuff. Does that mean that just people who, you know, rando people here in the St. Louis bi-state region who could be betting on sports could have been affected by the way that players chose to play the game, chose to fake an injury? Like, could this have affected regular old people who were just betting because they thought it was fun?
Maybe. I don't know what the buy-in was for these games, but I think you had to probably put down a lot of money or have a lot of money available at your disposal. And the lure is, I mean, who wouldn't want to play golf with you know, a great professional golfer? Who wouldn't want to kick a soccer ball with Ronaldo? Who wouldn't want to ski with, you know, one of the greatest pro skiers, et cetera? So this is a chance for some people to come in and sort of hobnob and rub elbows with famous NBA folks. I suspect the buy-in was, what, 50, 100, 200,000 at least. I know in the indictment, if you look at page 17 and 18, it talks about, you know, minimum of $50,000 per game. But I don't know what the buy-in was. So I just think it's way too early. And these indictments just have a massive ripple effect, Annie. And we're going to see that ripple effect play out. And I think we're actually going to see people take themselves off of teams or find themselves injured for the rest of the season, quote unquote, as this thing starts playing out. Because people will start talking. Once they lawyer up, they're going to say, well, look at Ralphie over here. Look at Sam over here. Talk to him. I gave him all this stuff, so this is going to ripple big time.
Wow. All right. Well, we will continue to follow it. I want to shift gears here. Let's go to the Northwest, to Portland. Once again, we see Portland, Oregon saying, no, Trump, we've got everything under control. There's nothing to see here. Everything is fine. And President Trump says, obviously, not everything is fine. He wants to send in the National Guard. They sue. They get the injunction or whatever the correct legal language is to stop the process that the president is engaging in. But now we have the Ninth Court or Circuit Court of Appeals overturning that previous ruling once again. And President Trump is one step closer to sending the National Guard into Portland. That's from an Axios Portland report. Talk to me about the legal ping pong that takes place when the president is trying to mobilize the National Guard, uses federal ICE agents to enforce federal laws, specifically in places like Oregon, California, Chicago, and the like.
So we're seeing a spate of activist judges who clearly have a mild to moderate case of Trump derangement syndrome who are issuing injunctions or stopping the president's policy preferences under the guise of the law. And they issue these injunctions, like in Portland, this district court judge substituted her opinion for the facts in the case, which is what the appeals court said about this district court judge. You've seen it in Chicago. You keep seeing it. I just was with at an event with a senator who from Missouri, Senator Schmidt, who was talking about how, as of today, the Trump administration is 25-2 before the Supreme Court. 25 wins versus 2. Now, most of these are preliminary hearings, preliminary emergency motions on the emergency docket. But, I mean, you're just seeing across the board, Portland's a perfect example, where these district court judges just are not following the law and are basically writing opinions that are essentially their policy preference. And then appeals courts either get it right or it goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, no, you didn't apply the law, you didn't do this, and send it back down and reverses them. And this is going to continue until judges just call balls and strikes. I mean, of course the president has the authority as the commander in chief to use the National Guard to protect federal buildings and federal troops during the operation of federal law enforcement officers. Obviously, he has the authority to do that. He's not sending, like he has here in D.C., which is a different cat, them to be like extra policemen, which is, you know, a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. He's using it to protect federal buildings and federal law enforcement officers. And so any suggestion to the contrary is a policy suggestion and not a legal one.
Just your thoughts before we let you go. We're speaking with Cully Stimson, a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. You said 25-2 or 27-2? What was the number?
I thought it was 25-2 that I heard.
25-2. Yep. So you've got a president who's 25-2 and in winning those court cases. That's a pretty darn good record, I would say. A government shutdown where you have the president repeatedly saying, get the government open, trying to figure out how to fund things around Congress to make sure that our federal workers don't go unpaid. Just constitutionally speaking, legally speaking, I would feel like if President Trump were trying to act as though he were a king, that he'd be able to snap his fingers and open the government. He would be getting creamed in the courts for trying to do things that would go against the Constitution. Just in your opinion, how much of a monarchy are the people of this country suffering under right now?
None. Zero.
Period.
Nada. Period. We're in a democratic republic. Remember, the federal government was created by the states, not the other way around. And the people in the states have police power. The federal government has no police power. And the president, under our Constitution, is the commander-in-chief and the chief law enforcement officer. And so he's wearing that latter hat when he sees these dystopian hellholes like Chicago, like Philadelphia, which he hasn't gone to yet, but I think he should, Portland, like Memphis, where the local leaders aren't stepping up and protecting the people who deserve to be protected the most, especially minority neighborhoods. And so he's not going to let ICE agents and federal agents enforcing immigration laws or federal buildings, he's not going to let those ICE agents and federal agents be assaulted, and he's not going to let those federal buildings be destroyed. And so they can do their little No Kings thing and all their silliness and dress up like weird pet animals. But what is the alternative? Where is the positive alternative policy proposals? Well, we saw in the last administration. Open the border, don't enforce the laws, spy on Republicans, trample on the First Amendment. And the American people rejected that. Yeah. And the people who lost are having a massive hissy fit. And so they're acting out like a toddler who doesn't get a second scoop of ice cream. It's ridiculous.
Oh, the left and that president love ice cream. That is for certain. Gully Stinson, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it. We look forward to following up. A lot of things to discuss in the Berkeley Guest Podcast today.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a place where we're not afraid to dig in. Smash that subscribe button wherever you get podcasts.